If last year was big, this year is mega.
2014.
Sci-fi, comic books, and anime at the largest convention in the South. Featuring special guests Stan Lee, Torchwood's John Barrowman and Ron Perlman. Meet David Morrissey, Emily Kenney, and the cast from Walking Dead. Comic book creators, costume contests, and more.
2014.
March 21st through 23rd at the Orange County Convention Center. Get discounted tickets early at megaconvention.com.
Hi, I'm Eric Esquivel, author of Loki, Ragnarok, and Roll, and you're listening to We Be Geeks.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries are powered. Turbine
speed. Transmission commencing.
My name is Optimus Prime.
All wings, check in.
Red 3 standing by.
Red 6 standing by.
Red 5 standing by.
Red Button standing by.
Red Fox standing by.
Big Red standing by.
Red October standing by.
Helen Reddy standing by.
Simply Red standing by.
Great Scott!
So, the bad crowd you've been hanging out with is a science fiction club?
Back at the above ground underwater suborbital volcano lair.
It is another edition of We Be Geeks. I am your host, Mike, and on the other side we have Marty. How are you doing tonight, Marty?
Doing pretty good. How about you?
Good. You know, we got a special guest with us tonight.
Yeah, and this is our big time guest.
And we're just waiting for him to pop on. So let me see if we can get him on. We're going to the listeners, it's going to sound seamless, but for us, it's going to be a couple minutes. So hang right tight, and as soon as you hear us again, we're right back with our special guest. It's a secret. So, Marty, our special guest is on the line. We said it was a secret guest. You mentioned it was one of our biggest guests to date. People my age, I know I'm quite a bit older than most, might remember him as Miles from Risky Business. He's got one of my favorite lines from the movie Better Off Dead of, do you know how much the street value of this mountain is? Most people know him from Revenge of the Nerds and most recently King of the Nerds. Booger himself, Curtis Armstrong. How you doing tonight, Curtis?
I'm doing great, guys. Nice to be here.
So I was looking at your credits earlier this week. 137 different acting credits between shorts and TV and movies.
Yeah, that's about, and that doesn't count stage appearances either.
All right.
Another 30 of those. So
wow.
It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I started going down a list and I was like, I think it's actually going to be shorter to list what you haven't been in than what you have been. Cause you've made like appearances in like, it, you know, at least, probably over a dozen just well-known TV shows. You've gotten appearances in those. You've done movies. It's quite a remarkable list that you've compiled for yourself.
Well, it's, you know, it's one of those things where you realize at a certain point in your life that you've had a career. And I reached that point about 20 years ago. And even then I was thinking, and it was actually funny. I was doing a show with somebody, a younger actor, and I remember him, telling me, you know, asking me what I was doing aside from his show, and I was, you know, naming things, but I, you know, they weren't particularly, you know, earth shattering. And I guess I sounded a little, you know, dismissive of the sort of stuff I'd been doing of late. And he was the one who pointed out to me, he said, don't you realize you are somebody who has had a career that people like who are starting out like me look at, you know, as something that they would like to have. And this was, a revelation to me because I wasn't thinking of myself in the long term as somebody with a career, but now it's hard not to.
Well, and part of that maybe is because you had like that iconic role that really just kind of, you got stuck with almost like a name of a character that you play that people instantly recognize, like, hey, there's Booger. That's
yeah.
Like every time you pop up. And for some people that could have been, almost like a deal breaker, like a resume killer in some ways. But it's that's the even more remarkable thing is that you've actually been able to take that and go in every direction that you can possibly think of as far as roles.
I don't think of it as – I've never thought of typecasting as really a bad thing. It never really – you know, I mean, Booger, I mean, you have to realize when we did Revenge of the Nerds, this is – we're talking 1984 – and we were looking at it as actors, all of us, everybody in Revenge of the Nerds were all, actors with considerable experience. You know, Brian and Robert had careers going back to the 60s. And so we were people who, you know, were looking at this at that point as another job. Mm-hmm. And without at all the idea that this was going to be something that would become iconic or, you know, something that people would be quoting or that I would be talking about, 30 years after it appeared in theaters. So, you know, it's how we look at it is always different than how everyone else looks at it.
Was there ever a thought when you first were approached with the role of just not doing it?
Absolutely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I remember this was actually something I hadn't thought about in a while. I was living in New York when I auditioned for Revenge of the Nerds. I wasn't out here. And one of my best friends in New York was Bronson Pinchot. He and I had been in Risky Business together.
Right.
That's right.
So we're living in New York and we're, you know, waiting for Risky Business to come out, and it took forever because they had to reshoot the ending, and it just took forever. And, in the meantime, you know, we're running out of money and we're, you know, getting together every once in a while and saying this really sucks and, you know, we need a job and all this. And then Revenge of the Nerds comes along and Bronson read for Revenge of the Nerds.
Really?
Yes, and that's something that no one remembers, and I'm sure he never talks about it. He had gone in for an audition for it, and I had done an audition for it. And when we were brought in to read for it, we were given Tony's sides, Gilbert, the character Gilbert.
Okay.
Because the rest of the nerds in the script at that point were so small. The parts were so small, you couldn't really read anybody, you know, because there wasn't enough dialogue. So they gave us those sides. And Bronson went through one audition, and then it was over for him. And then I got a call, and the call was from my agent saying, well, they want to know, you're not cast as that part, but they want to know whether you would consider another role. And I remember calling Bronson and the two of us raging with anger because Bronson didn't get the part and now I didn't get the part and they want to know if I want to take another role. And then I'm going through the script and I'm going, wait a minute. Well, it can't be Takashi. It can't be Lamar. Wormser. The only thing it could possibly be was Booger. And I remember the conversation with Bronson on the phone and me saying, well, I'm telling you right now, they offer me that part, forget it. I'll starve first. And then they called up and offered it to me and I said, of course.
You got the rage out first and then you're like, oh yeah, my cupboard's a little bare. I guess I better work.
That's exactly right.
Now, when doing the filming, did y'all experience, like they talk about with Planet of the Apes, the jocks sat together on lunch breaks or meal breaks, and the nerds sat together, and then everyone else sat together? Or was there an intermingle?
Well, there was intermingling. I mean, we partied together, but we had been, the nerds had been brought to Tucson like a week and a half early, before anyone else, to work with the writers and the director on the script, because the script was not great when we got it, the original script. And, they were aware of it. And so there were two of the writers down there. And they were working with us so that every day we would go in and we would have ideas and we pitched, you know, who we thought these characters were because they were, you know, they were so elusive in on the page, you couldn't really tell who anybody was aside from Lewis and Gilbert. So, you know, we would go in and we would, you know, talk and have ideas and kick them back and forth and that kind of thing. And then we go back out into the pool area and sit around until dinner time. I mean, that was really the extent of our rehearsal. And then, by the end of that week, the other actors started arriving. And, you know, there was no separation between us, no false, you know, walls, you know, put up about, well, they play the jocks, they're, you know, jocks. Everybody was pretty much partying at the same level, you know, at the same time. So we would just move from room to room in this little motel, in Tucson. And it was actually great because there was another movie in the same place. So we basically, these two movies had taken over this entire motel. And, the other one was called, a movie called, Flashpoint with, Treat Williams and Chris Christopherson.
Yep.
And, you know, so Chris would come down to the bar at night. And Robert would bring his guitar and Chris would bring his guitar and the two of them would sit in the bar and just play all night. Oh, wow. And the rest of us would sit around Goodman and me and Larry B and Brian, all these people, Julie, we'd sit around drinking in the bar and listening to Christopherson and Bobby Carradine play guitar. It was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
go ahead. Marty.
I was going to say, you'd mentioned that when you got there that they were still kind of hammering out the script. And
yeah.
as an actor, did that kind of make you a little bit nervous about what you were getting yourself into?
No, I mean, I didn't have very high expectations, frankly. You know, I mean, I really didn't. None of us did. I mean, we saw the script. We went, well, I mean, you know, I'd done only one film, so I really didn't know. I'd done a film in which a guy had spent 7 years crafting every word and gone into production knowing what every camera angle was and what, you know, every music cue was and all that kind of thing. So, you know, that had been an experience, a unique experience for me. And now I was going into something which was completely haphazard, it appeared. But I wasn't worried about it because we didn't think that this was a movie that was going to go down in history, you know, to say the least. This was something that was, you know, going to, you know, play for 5 days in, you know, Atlanta and then disappear.
Right.
Because there was no, I mean, there was no, you know, cable to speak of. There was no, you know, home video to speak of that would extend the lives of movies like this. And when those things came along, that's what made cult movies in the 80s, was the ability to, you know, if you had cable, to watch them on cable, or if you had, you know, the early VHS players to get your tape, you know, for $80 or whatever it was. And then that was how people, you know, how those movies got their longevity is because of that. But we didn't know that at the time. We just thought, we'll get paid, we'll do this, we'll have some fun, and then we'll go home.
Well, getting a little sidetracked off Revenge of the Nerds real quick, being a child of the 80s myself, it's my high school years, how does it feel knowing that a good number of the movies you did, Risky Business, Better Off Dead, the Nerd films, were the movies flying off the shelves or highly requested at the video rental stores at the time?
I don't know. I think it took a while before I was really aware of that. You know, once again, you know, you were experiencing one thing. I was really, you know, I had sort of moved on and, you know, we did get together a couple more times to do a couple of more movies. But, you know, I really wasn't aware of it that much. It was really, you know, once again, we're getting back into the technology thing. It was really when the internet became so popular that that's when you begin to realize the extent to which you've influenced people. I mean, I would get fan mail and things like that, and people would stop me in the street. So I was aware of it, but not aware of it in the same way you were. It didn't strike me as being a you know, seismic thing at all. It was just some people had seen the movie and enjoyed it.
Okay. Now, the infamous scene involving your character, the belching scene, that mm-hmm. bring any worries when you saw that in the script on how they're going to pull it off?
Well, there were so many obnoxious things in the script that I was being asked to do that was really just one more. So I can't say that it was anything that shocked me. And I approached it the same way that I would approach anything. It sounds crazy because it's a belching scene, but you know, obviously I was, you know, both Don Gibb and I were pretending to belch. We obviously weren't doing that. You know, there wasn't a great, you know, David was the principal, and he's up there and he's giving us the introduction. We come up and we do our belching, and then we sit down, or they cheer and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was one of the last shots of the day. The sun was going down. It was horribly hot. My face looks like a, you know, fried egg, from the heat. And I just remember doing it and not really, you know, just thinking, well, that's one more. But I mean, was it any more disturbing to me personally than picking my nose or, you know, saying the thing? You know, it was all pretty much the same thing. There was a funny thing though. A year later, I was in Spain and I was doing a movie there. And one of my acting heroes was in the movie, Alan Arkin. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited, and I had got to meet him. I was introduced to him. And we were living in this little village, staying at a posada in a little village in Spain. So we would eat together in the dining room of this place. And one morning I'm there. After having met him a few days earlier, I was having breakfast there, and he came in and sat at my table. And I was so excited. And he said, you know, when I met you, I thought I knew you from somewhere. Well, how could he possibly? He said, and I finally figured it out. Revenge of the Nerds. And I said, you saw Revenge? I was mortified that Alan Arkin had seen this horrible movie. And he said, yeah, my boys wanted to see it. I took him to see it, and you know, it was funny. I really liked it. And he said, I especially like, you know, the scene that you did, the burping scene. You were very funny in that. The way you concentrated before the belch, that was really funny. And I was like on the moon. This man had given me a compliment about the belching scene. It was as happy as I've ever been.
that's big. One question I've always kind of been curious about was did you consider yourself a nerd before Revenge of the Nerds, when you know the nerd term kind of really came to prominence?
I didn't think of it in that way. I didn't think of myself as a nerd, because mm-hmm. although I remember there was a, I don't know, you probably don't remember, but there was a a musical group called the Roaches, in the 80s, three sisters, Maggie, Terry, and Suzzy Roach, and I loved them. And their second album had a song on it called Nerds, but it was spelled N-U-R-D-S. And it was clearly about sort of the outcast, the person who doesn't fit in. Sort of thing, but it was very funny. It was, you know, in that style that they had. And so I guess the term was sort of floating around, but I didn't think of myself as a nerd. I considered myself an outsider when I was in college. I mean, in high school and college, come to that. And I was more of a book nerd. I, you know, stayed in my room. I didn't date. I couldn't get dates. And, you know, I was really kind of sad, during those years. And, you know, it started to pick up towards the end of high school because I got into the theater and I found something which, you know, which I could do well. And, so I started making friends because of that. But yeah, I was definitely one of those, and I was definitely, especially earlier on in middle school and so on, I was ostracized, I was mocked, I was beaten up, I was pushed into lockers, you know, the whole deal. Mm-hmm. That happened all the time to me.
Hmm. Did you find any of that, like, good, you know, recognition, or not recognition, but recall for when you guys came up with your characters? Did you kind of go down some of those old high school memory lanes to add to your nerd character?
Not really. I mean, I was aware of it. I mean, everybody knows their history, but I don't remember ever saying, you know what happened to me? We should put this in.
Right.
You know, a lot of what Booger does in that movie was there. I mean, there just wasn't very much. And a lot of it had to be, there was improv done, so that there are a lot of scenes in the film that were not in the script that came out literally on the set. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't really, I mean, I was talking about this the other day. I was remembering that because I trained in the theater, I trained as a stage actor, and one of the things that we've been taught was that we had to write a biography of your character before you started anything. You wrote a biography so that even if it didn't matter to the audience, you knew where you came from and what your past life was and what your experiences were. Mm-hmm. And I had done one for Booger. And I found it recently in a note down in the basement. And I, you know, looked at it, and I saw, my God, it's my Booger biography. And from 1984, I still have this notebook. And so I was looking at it, and I realized it was so interesting because here I had written a biography about a character who has no connection to me at all. I don't get Booger at all, who he is. It's no connection to me. And when I write my biography, I think I've done this great biography of this character. And when I look at it as an adult, I go, well, that was me. And I couldn't believe it. I looked at it and saw I was writing about me and wasn't even aware of it at the time.
Wow.
You know, I was 30 years old and now I'm 60. And at 30, I was unaware of who I was to the point that I didn't recognize myself in this biography.
Wow. That's a beautiful thing about acting, is when you can kind of take some of those pieces of yourself, maybe not the whole thing, but you can take those pieces and apply it to a character that you've been cast as, and then kind of almost see yourself in a different light as a result. You kind of have that opportunity to live out somebody else's life without having all the repercussions that follow.
Yeah, I suppose.
I suppose.
Now, with the more modern term geek brought around, do you see a difference between nerd and geek, or do you see them as pretty much the same?
Well, it depends on who you ask. On King of the Nerds, you know, it was a big question for us in the first season because we were still trying to find our way kind of with a new show, and we'd never been in a situation like this where we had 11 people who were all nerds all together. And it was one of the questions that we asked a lot of ourselves, in addition to being asked by other people. And the best answer I got out of it was, I don't know if there is a definitive answer, but the one that I got out of the nerds from the first season was that nerd tends to be a more generalized term. It means, nowadays, it means the overall, the person who is the outsider, the slightly dysfunctional, uncomfortable, maybe, you know, a bit of an outsider, that kind of person who's also very intelligent, who loves and is very passionate about nerd pastimes, whatever they are, that it takes in everything. It takes in the science nerds, it takes in the book nerds, it takes in the cosplay nerds, it takes everybody in under that umbrella of nerd. Whereas geek is more specific. So you don't say that you're a Star Trek nerd, you say you're a Star Trek geek, which is a more narrow definition of your passion. That's the way it was described to me, and it's as good a description as any, I think.
Hmm. Okay. Now, I remember one of the first times I remember seeing you before Revenge of the Nerds was also on Moonlighting.
Well, that's after Revenge of the Nerds.
Well, for me, I didn't get a chance to see Revenge of the Nerds right away.
Mm.
So my first was seeing you on Moonlighting.
I see what you're saying.
I think about 2 years later, I was able to catch Revenge of the Nerds watching late night on HBO or Showtime, one of those. What was it like, going from movies to all of a sudden doing a TV show and a very successful TV show at that?
Well, it was funny because with Moonlighting, it really was, such an amazing show to be on, and it was very much like making a movie every week, and or every 10 days, whatever, you know. We got in trouble with our shooting schedule because, you know, we would come up short, and, you know, it would be time to deliver a new show and we were still filming it, but the quality of the writing, the quality of the acting, the production, everything about Moonlighting was done with such care. It's, in a way, it's a little bit like Risky Business, actually. Glenn Caron, who created it, and Paul Brickman, both who did Risky Business, they both had that real serious focus, and everything was sort of done with their vision in mind, up to a point. And then both of them wound up having problems. Paul with David Geffen and Glenn with ABC and Sybil Shepherd. And it wound up in both cases, the original vision having been somewhat warped by circumstance. But when I was doing Moonlighting, I was thinking, all I could think was, people had been telling me to watch this show for months, and I just thought, my God, what a great gig. I just couldn't believe, you know, the way that they did it every week was just so, it was like making a movie, you know? And I had made movies prior to Moonlighting, which I'm nowhere near as proud of as Moonlighting. So, you know, just the fact that you're doing a movie doesn't make it good. And just because you're doing a TV show doesn't make it bad. So I was really thrilled with Moonlighting, thrilled with the opportunity to be working with those people, and thrilled to be making money on a long-term basis for the first time. That was all really, you know, wonderful. But even then, even at the very beginning, Bruce Willis, the first day I was there, was talking to me about, and I remember him saying, "Why are you here?" And I said, "Well, it's a great, great show." He says, "You do movies. If I did movies, I would be out of here so fast."
Because that was at a time period where movies were the thing to do, and TV was kind of like your fallback, it felt like,
right?
Isn't it? Yeah.
That was still the case then. It is not the case anymore.
How do you like that turnover where it seems like it's kind of flip-flopped almost the other way in a lot of ways?
You know, it never mattered to me, to be honest with you, and I guess it's one of the ways in which I could have handled my career better if I were a different sort of a person. But basically, I was a character actor. I started out to be a character actor. It's all I wanted to be. I never thought I would do a movie. When I did Risky Business, it was a shock that I was actually, somebody had actually cast me in a movie, and I kept a journal for the whole time I was in Chicago shooting Risky Business because I thought I would never do another movie, and I wanted to remember what the experience was like. And then I went into the 80s. I was still doing stage, but I was doing more movies. Hmm. And then when Moonlighting came along, I was doing television. I never thought I would do television. And now here I am doing television. So all of these things came along at the time in which they were supposed to come. And then after Moonlighting, you know, it was a combination of all of them. And it's been a combination of all of them ever since. And some of them are embarrassing. And some of them are great, and I'm enormously proud of them. But it's all part of what I do for a living. So as long as I was working, I was happy. And that's why I took jobs, and some people, including me, will look back on them and say, what were you thinking? I mean, all of the signs pointed to this being a disaster, and you took it anyway. And the reason I took it was because, you know, it was offered to me, and it was a job.
Right.
And sometimes it was because people were in it that I wanted to work with, or the writer was someone who interested me, or the part was a good one, whether the script was not. It never mattered to me. And there are people, and a lot of the guys I worked with in the 80s, who went about it in a very different way. And, they went their way and I went mine. I don't see that I was ever destined to be anything other than what I am. And I get great pleasure out of it, and I'm glad that, you know, at my advanced age, I'm still doing it.
How did you jump into the world of voice acting?
That was Savage Steve Holland who got me into that. Because when we had done both movies. We'd done Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer. And he was then doing some TV, and he and Bill Kopp, who I worked with later on Dan Versus, Bill Kopp and Savage created this show called Eek the Cat, which has a kind of legendary, it's one of those things that has disappeared, and everybody would love to see it again. It was a really funny and really creative and slightly subversive animated show. And there was a spin-off from it called The Terrible Thunder Lizards.
And
I was one of the two cavemen who were the stars of this show, who were the characters who created everything. I mean, like, you know, one week we would create a washing machine. One week we would create a lawyer. I mean, it was really a brilliant show and very funny with a great cast, a lot of people. Kurtwood Smith was in it.
Yep.
It was great. That was how it started. And I did a couple episodes of Eek, and then I did the whole run of Terrible Thunder Lizards. And after that, I couldn't get arrested for like 10 years. I could not get a voiceover job of any kind. And then, I'm trying to remember what the first one was. I don't even remember now, but I read for something and, you know, I had an agent, but I never got the jobs. And then something came up. I don't remember even now what it was, but that started it. And then, you know, started working on various projects for Disney and then wound up doing for the Hub, doing Dan Versus, which was my one of my favorite roles of all time. Mm-hmm. And then for Nickelodeon, Robot and Monster, which was another great favorite. They were running at the same time. And I guess they're still out there on reruns, but they're both canceled. And, you know, I'm doing a feature with Disney now. So it's become another part of my career, and I really enjoy doing it.
Is it possible we could ask what feature you're working on with Disney?
It's the sequel to Planes.
Oh, okay. Planes, Fire, and Rescue.
Planes, Fire, and Rescue, yes.
Yeah.
I am playing a plane.
I'm actually my real job is I'm an audio engineer over at Epcot here at Walt Disney World.
Oh, really?
So it's company film.
Yes, it is. I'm going back in a couple of weeks to do some more recording on it, actually.
Oh, cool. Yeah, my daughter loved Planes, and I know she's interested in seeing this, so I will be seeing it.
What's the name of the character that you're playing?
The name of the character is, oh, God. You know, I've been working on this for 2 years, and it's late at night, and I can't remember the character's name. Sorry.
That's okay. Now, yeah. with Dan Versus, I remember actually watching that with my young son and seeing I just heard the name and didn't see the opening credits, and I heard your voice, and I was like, I know that voice, and it was bugging the crap out of me. I finally looked it up, saw you had done it, but I want to say in the credits you also had, like, were you like a producer in that show as well?
No, or
had like more like it was almost felt like it might have been more input from you for the show or not.
No input from me at all. It's entirely their doing. And I was just, the only input was I was able to really lasso the rage over just the stupidest things in the world, yeah. which was really fun. And working with Paget Brewster and Dave Foley, when those weeks when the three of us managed to get there at the same time and be in the booth together, I don't remember ever laughing so hard. It was always so much fun. It was really a great show, and I miss terribly it being gone. I really do. I would have loved it, for it to continue. Robot and Monster too. Right. I really am, you know, they were very dear to my heart. Fortunately, I'm still also doing American Dad, which I've been doing now for 6 years or something. Wow. And, that's been a great, great gig as well.
What's it like to work with Seth MacFarlane? Does he give you?
Well, I don't work with him much. In the early days, he was around more. Mm-hmm. But they have a different method there. I mean, that's Fox Animation, and they do it differently than the Hub did, or than Nickelodeon did, or Disney did. They bring everybody in individually, and you do your lines in this vacuum, and they have a read through of the script. But at this stage, after all these years, a lot of the actors, you know, don't even have to be there at this point. And Seth is so busy doing everything else that he's not been in the read-throughs for a long time. Or I think the last one, which was a big Snot episode, was the one where Snot and, Roger wind up becoming friends. And, Seth was working on Ted. So he was in Boston, I guess, and he phoned in, you know, so he could read with us on that. And that was the last time I've even heard his voice. he's got so much going on. And, so I've been it's gone back to just showing up and going into the booth and reading my lines.
Right.
Now, you're currently one of the two hosts of King of the Nerds. How did this project come about, and were you surprised to hear there was a season two?
I was, the way that it came about was Robert Carradine and I had gotten together, and we were just talking, and this was about 7 years ago, it was at the time when, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, reality shows, and the two of us are, you know, still going on with our careers and trying to put our kids through college and all that stuff. And he just said, you know, we should just come up with a reality show instead of complaining about it. We should just come up with one and, you know, base it on Revenge of the Nerds. And I mean, so we started talking about it. We thought, well, you know, if we present ourselves as executive producers, create this show, and then say that we're going to host it, then, you know, that would be an advantage. So we pitched it, and it honestly didn't get much response at the time. And part of the reason was Beauty and the Geek was on. I think there was a consensus that one nerd show, even a fake nerd show, was better than none. So they passed on it, and we just went, okay, well, that was a nice try anyway. And so we forgot about it. And then a few years later, we decided to try again. And this time, the whole zeitgeist had changed, and everybody was suddenly, you know, interested. So the company, 5x5 Media, basically said, don't talk to anybody about this. You know, and he got TBS involved and Alexis, and so we were off. And it took about a year and a half to negotiate the deal and arrange for what we were going to do. But then once that was all out of the way, we cast our nerds, and it was fantastic. I mean, I don't know what I expected, but I never thought, obviously, I never thought I would be on a reality show, let alone create one. But I was, here I was being on a reality show, but these nerds were just so compelling. I couldn't drag myself out of the monitor room where we would sit and watch them. I would just sit there whenever I wasn't on camera. I would sit there watching them. You know, it was like, you know, like watching, you know, animals in the wild, not aware that you're watching them. It was just so interesting. And I really liked them so much as people. And, so we went through that, and, you know, it takes forever to do those things, and the editing and the post and all that. It takes forever. And when it finally premiered, we really didn't know what to expect. And the response was almost immediate, and then we got picked up for a second season. It was like heaven. And so the second season, I was much more involved in the pre-production of everything. I went to the meetings. I went to casting meetings and budget meetings and challenge meetings and location scouts and all of that kind of thing, because it was just so much fun. And so interesting, and such a different experience for me. And then going into the casting for the second season, which was just a dazzling experience, because, you know, you wind up with 11 people who are just so remarkable as people. And whatever their quirks, they have accomplished so much. And they're so much smarter than me. So of course what winds up happening is I wind up falling in love with all of these nerds. And it's true. I am, and I admit it to the world. I love these nerds. And I wind up becoming friends with the nerds. And these other executives on the show who've done shows like Survivor and Amazing Race and, you know, all these other competition reality shows, and they think I'm nuts. But I just, you know, a lot of those nerds from season one and two have become really good friends of mine. And I value the experience of knowing them, and I hope I know them for a long time, because they're amazing people. Mm-hmm. And I hope the show runs for a long time. It has been a great, unexpected gift.
What would you say is like the biggest thing that you learned from season one that you were able to kind of adjust and fix for season two? Was there any kind of big learning curve you felt?
There was a huge learning curve, and, you know, in some ways we're still learning. I mean, you know, there were certain obvious things that were happening in the first season that it became obvious that we needed to figure out. One of them was we needed a Nerdvana with indoor plumbing. the Nerdvana that we had, we thought had plumbing and didn't.
Mm.
And it's a great set. And it was designed beautifully by, and decorated beautifully by our crew, but there was no working toilets. And, at one point, I guess, or they started out working and then backed up into the basement, and it was a nightmare for everybody. So the idea was we needed to find a better location. The other thing, which was really more important since no one really was aware of that, was the fact that we needed to find a new way to end the competition. Mm. We were never entirely sold on the way that we ended it when it came down to Genevieve and Celeste. Mm-hmm. But honestly, in the fury of that experience and the excitement of it, I have to admit that personally, not speaking for anyone else, personally, I took my eye off the ball when it came to that, because if I had really thought about it, I would have said, you know, this is a popularity contest,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing that belongs less on a reality show about nerds than a popularity contest, since we never win them.
Right.
And so when... But even though on some level I think we knew that it was kind of a weak way to end it, I think we just went, well, this is what we've got, so we went with it. Mm-hmm. Which is all taking nothing away from Celeste, because mm-hmm. she was a great strategic player, and she got where she was not by mistake. Mm-hmm. Believe me, nobody on that show gets to the end of the show by mistake. But when you have a group of people, half of whom have missed half of what's going on in the house, they have to then rely on what they have heard from other people about what the two people who are the finalists, you know, which one of them deserved it. And when you get into the politics that can come up, when you had somebody like Danielle, who was deeply resentful of Genevieve, mm-hmm. and, you know, Alana had problems, and, you know, there were various people who had, you know, personal issues, about other people. Once that becomes part of the deal, it makes it very hard to get an honest, you know, decision,
mm-hmm.
Because there's too much emotion involved. And so that was part of the problem with the end of last season. And we felt that if we did get a pickup, we were going to need to come up with a better way to do it. And this year, as everyone will see a week from tomorrow, we have come up with a solution.
Okay. Now, without getting too far into what's coming up with season two, the rest of season two, just what we've seen so far. Were y'all worried about the possibility of how much of a loose cannon Zach might be? Or might have been?
No, not at all. I mean, it came as a shock to me. Because it wasn't immediate, you know, and there was nothing. And, you know, here's the thing about Zach. When you meet Zach, you know, Zach is a very normal guy. It's just that what happens when you put people in that kind of a pressure cooker, anyone with, you know, any temper or, you know, passion about something, they are under enormous stress. And a lot of times I don't think people realize how much stress they're under. And when you've got people, you know, and we had last year with Virgil and with Joshua. There were different things going on with them in relation to other people, Alana also, that, you know, you have to sort of ride those waves and figure out, you know, you have to trust that the group is going to work it out amongst themselves. And then once we get into editing, we can figure out a way to tell the story that isn't, you know, shocking. Or that doesn't stoke the fire in some way. And with Zach, I don't think we realized until it happened. I mean, we knew he was prickly, and we knew that he had felt bullied by other people in the house. That was part of the deal, that he was reacting to what he felt were provocations, whether they were or not, or whether other people saw them as that, or is not important. But he responded in that way, and we then, you know, have to deal with that. And as what wound up happening is, unlike the first season, it became a situation where it was Zach against everyone else, pretty much. I mean, there were small flare-ups between other people, but basically it became a story. The first three episodes were about Zach. And, you know, I kind of regretted it for a lot of reasons. You know, I was worried that it was too much of a cloud, that it was too intense. I found it disturbing to watch personally. And I was concerned about it, but a lot of other people seem to feel like, you know, this is what we deal with, and we do. And, you know, of course, as it happens, we look at the response to the show now. There are a lot of people who don't like Zach, but there are a lot of people who adore Zach. And he's become, for right or wrong, he's become a high, you know, a breakout character in this second season.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't know what to say. You know, these are the kinds of things you want, a degree of drama. Our show, one of the things I love about it is that not only is it smart, but it has a lot of comedy to it, and it has a lot of heart to it. I don't like getting into arguments with people. I don't like watching arguments with people. But this, you know, turned out the way it turned out. Ultimately, I don't know that anyone has real regrets, any long-term, really, bad blood, you know. I mean, there are still people who are
hurt.
Well, yeah. I mean, there were some hurt feelings, you know, and I, that's something that you can't really do. But I mean, I've posted pictures on my Facebook page and on Twitter, of all of those people at my house having a party. You know, we spent the better part of a week, the premiere week. They were all out here in L.A., except for Katie and Josh, who couldn't make it. But they were all out here. And we had half of the first season crew, nerd cast, at the same party. It was the most fun in the world. So, you know, people go through these things, and it lands where it lands. It's the name of the game, you know?
I saw where, you know, the way Zach was presented on the show, I could tell there wasn't much editing to try and go away from it, but more to show the stress.
Anything. Never assume anything.
But his personality definitely shows that the stress is everyone goes through. Because isn't he one of the youngest contestants on the show?
Yes, he is. He's 21. So he's definitely on the young side. And in fact, I think he may have been the youngest contestant on either season. I don't think anybody was younger than that. But he is also, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate that it winds up being like that. So the discussion becomes about, the flare-ups and the anger and the, you know, all that stuff. I mean, I understand it. but it's unfortunate because the guy is also brilliant. Right. I mean, there's another whole side to him which nobody sees. And, you know, you can't show all sides of everybody. And there are other people on the show who've had the same argument, you know, from the first season too, where, you know, they said, well, they weren't really showing me the way I am. You know, they cut all of my best stuff. You know, well, you know, it's not a mini series. You know, we have to get through 8 episodes, you know, with about 42 minutes per episode. So, you know, yeah, a lot of stuff gets cut.
How long do you guys shoot for?
We shoot, it's almost exactly 8 weeks, I think.
Okay.
So the first season.
About a week per episode, is it good?
Yeah, or? It's about that. Okay. It's about that. I think it's between maybe 7 episodes, 7 weeks, something like that. It's like the month of July, maybe into August a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It varies, but that's kind of, that's when we've shot for, is that month of July.
Do you find it hard to have that balance, that straddling that line? Because you said you're still friends with everybody, but you also, and so you don't want to see the conflict, but you also, as the TV producer side of you, kind of wants to see a little of that conflict. Do you ever have that fight with yourself?
Sure, of course. I mean, that's part of the deal.
Yeah.
And don't mistake me. I don't hang out with the nerds. You know, it's a very strict thing, and it sounds funny now, but it's a very strict rule. Mm-hmm. Robert and I have no communication with these people for the entire run of the filming.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was, after the first season, I think I wound up with Genevieve and Ivan. Robert and I did some press with them. And I was so excited to meet them because I wanted to ask questions and about what was going on in the house that I wasn't aware of, and they wanted to ask me questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wound up going out to dinner and so on, and we just, the three of us, and just had a really great time. And then I started hooking up with other people. And then, you know, this season when we did, you know, the second one, the same thing happened. I went over there the last day when they were packed and about to be taken to the airport. And they were all gathered in the green room there, at Occidental. And I went in and we posed for pictures and it was the beginning of a relationship that I'm happy to say I have with all of them to some degree. And I will do it as long as there's a show. I can't do anything with them when we're shooting, but once we've wrapped them, they're mine.
Expect that friend request on Facebook.
That's right.
So, King of the Nerds has been picked up for season 3 then?
No, it has not. As we speak, it has not been picked up.
Okay.
So.
How soon do you have to usually bite your nails to find out?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, you know, we got killed pretty badly this year, because we were up against the Olympics for 3 weeks. Most shows. Yeah.
Nothing to worry about there.
Yeah. Most shows, are, you know, during that time were, doing reruns or not on at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, for some reason we were on. So we got hit pretty badly for those weeks, but our ratings have been great. And, last week it was like 1.4 million, which is really good for us. So I would say, you know, we're doing well as far as that goes. It's just up to TBS to make a decision about doing it, and we're just waiting on that.
So flood TBS through social media, through their email, and say want King of the Nerds 3.
I said that today on Twitter. that was one of the things, and I will say it again. I said, you know, calling all nerds, we need everybody tweeting during the show on Thursday night. You know, everybody, let TBS hear you. You know, I have every reason to believe that the show will be picked up for a third season, but until I hear it's been picked up for a third season, I'm not taking anything for granted. So if I can get people to get out there and tweet and, you know, do Facebook likes or, you know, send messages to TBS, to the website, you know, saying, you know, we need more King of the Nerds. You know, they do listen to that kind of thing. So, you know, that's what I'm hoping.
Right.
So what do you geek out or nerd out about these days? Or in the same, past?
Well, it's the same thing. I never, and this is, I think, the hallmark of a real nerd, is that you never grow out of your passion. It doesn't, you know, it's like Josh said this year, the people's nerd, the Pokemon master, who said, you know, there's a period of time where Pokemon ceased to be cool. And he said, I never got that memo, you know. for me, Pokemon is as cool as it ever was. And I'm sort of that way. My things when I was young, I had a great love for classic horror, the Universal cycles.
Yes. Yeah.
I had a great passion for Laurel and Hardy and the silent comics. Mm-hmm. I had a great passion for Sherlock Holmes. And I had a great passion for the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And those things are probably the core of what I still am the most passionate about. Mm-hmm. I have been a Sherlockian since I was 10, and I'm more driven as a Sherlockian than I have ever been in my life. I'm reading about 6 books about the Beatles right now. I'm a member of the Sons of the Desert Laurel and Hardy Appreciation Society. I'm a Baker Street Irregular. I love reading about and watching and rewatching old horror and science fiction films. Those are my passions, and they've always been, and always will be.
So, well, you know, we heard word that Universal's looking to remake the horror monsters.
God help us. Not interested. I am a fundamentalist, you know, when it comes to, and literally only in that respect. I am a fundamentalist when it comes to the things that I love. You know, people want to remake them, more power to you. Go ahead. Don't expect me to watch them.
Being a Beatles fan, have you picked up the graphic novel, The Fifth Beatle, from
Yes,
Buckles
I
Comics?
Have. I got it for Christmas, and I haven't read it yet. I'm in the middle of the Mark Lewisohn biography, okay. And yep. Of course, I ordered the English one, which is 2 volumes, massive volumes, which go only up to 1962. I'm in heaven. I love those books. Mark Lewisohn, if you're a Beatles fan, you know, spend the extra money, get the English edition of that book, because the stuff that was cut out for the American edition, it's incredibly rich and a great read.
The Beatles has been a big influence. It's one of the big influences on me as well. Especially knowing the technical side of things, you know, George Martin side, you know, with the mixing
right.
and everything. And then, you know, one of the last couple groups I worked with was a Beatles tribute group that was at Walt Disney World, the British Invasion. And so to know more about the albums, get in depth and get some of the, I don't know if they're bootlegs or the underground albums like the complete control room mixes or the separated tracks.
Yeah. Those were the ones that they used when they were putting those together for the Love soundtrack for the Cirque du Soleil. And,
yes.
And they've started doing the remastering and remixing in some cases of those. And as happens, those all came out and people really like them.
Just to listen to the tonal quality and knowing they were bounced 2 tracks to a time at a time.
Yeah,
to make such a great sound, it's incredible.
Well, I think one of the revelations for everybody who's really paying attention to this kind of stuff is, I think finally Ringo Starr is getting some credit. Because in those early recordings, because of the way they were done, you know, he was mixed so far in the back most of the time. And, I mean, there were times on Rain or, you know, the end, you know, where he had moments where, you know, it was in the 4. but the great drumming that he was doing consistently, and that was, you know, people just sort of heard it but didn't really hear it. And the only thing that I really love about these new whatever they are, bootlegs.
The remasters, yeah.
Or even
the remasters as well.
You know, is that you're hearing the rhythm section. You always could hear McCartney because he would always come in and redub his bass. Right. You know, after everything else was done, he would come in and redub the bass. But the drums were wherever the drums were. And now people are beginning to look at Ringo Starr and say, you know, everybody thought he was just, you know, a lucky man. And now they look at him as a great drummer, which he was. A great drummer.
Same thing with George Harrison. I mean, a lot of his vocals
were buried
in the mix.
You know, when you're the guitarist, you know, and you have a career beyond that, you have the ability to get it out there. And people, it's a little easier to follow the guitarist. The drummer tends to be something that gets lost, you know?
Yeah.
And so I love that. And I love the fact that I think musically people appreciate them even more now than they did when I was listening to them when they first got here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned... Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I have a 14-year-old niece that thinks they're the greatest thing ever, and you know, you can't disprove that she's wrong in that fact either. So,
well, no. I mean, my daughter, who is a music fiend, and she has actually a radio show out of her college at Smith College right now, and she credits the Beatles as being the first music that changed her life.
Wow.
So, yeah. I wouldn't argue.
My 4-year-old daughter is the same way. I mean, I expose her a lot to the Beatles. We expose her to the Police, the Floyd, my wife with Pat Benatar and country music. I mean, when she turns 10, this is going to be a kid that goes, you're not a Beatles fan because you truly don't know.
Right. Well, that's the way it is with my daughter, and on her radio show, which is called No Stairway. She plays music from blues of the 20s to post-punk of the 90s. Wow. That's the scope. And it's everything in between. And it's a musical education listening to my daughter's radio show. And it thrills me to know that this little girl who I used to play, you know, started with classical music and folk music, going on to Beatles, going on to British Invasion, you know, Kinks and Who and Motown. I'm from Detroit, so Motown was always playing. And then, you know, she just took all of that and absorbed it and then went on from there and wound up introducing me to music that was playing when I was her age, but I missed. And, you know, so it's been a mutual teaching experience with my daughter Lily and me.
Now I gotta ask, did she take any cues? Did she get any advice for you since you did play a DJ on that 70s show?
No. I forgot about that. That's right.
I for some reason that's one of my favorite moments on that 70s show because I worked radio for many a year, and that was always the case. You know, we didn't have the limelight like a 70s or 80s DJ did, but it was like the case of, you know, listeners would call in and fall in love with you, and then you meet them out someplace and it would just like instantly dissipate because none of either one of your expectations were up to the standards.
Exactly.
That you had.
Exactly. Yeah, that was really fun. I mean, that was a great gig. And having Howard Hessman there and Alice Cooper and,
right.
I mean, it was just, you know, it was kind of magic. It was really a lot of fun.
That's right. Cause I think the end credits, I think you guys were all sitting around playing.
That's right. We were in the basement. That's right. We were in the basement doing the stoned bit.
Right. Right.
It was really fun.
Now you mentioned you're working on Planes, Fire and Rescue. What other projects do you have coming up?
Well, right now I'm doing a couple of TV shows at the same time, which has never happened to me before. In addition to King of the Nerds, I've been doing Supernatural, the CW show, which is in its ninth season.
Oh, Right.
And so I've been going up to Vancouver to shoot that, and that has been one of the great TV experiences because they've written this just sublimely evil character who also remains, you know, articulate and funny, which is just a perfect mixture. And I am really enjoying that. And then I'm also doing New Girl with Zooey Deschanel. Okay. And I'm playing the principal in her school where she teaches. And so with New Girl, I get to be the sort of hapless idiot that I've played so often. But I get to play it with Zooey Deschanel, which is like so much fun. It's hard to believe. Then at the same time, you know, the next week I'll be up in Vancouver, throwing all of the angels out of heaven and slamming the gates shut. I mean, that's as great a kind of thing as you can have as an actor, that kind of vast, different type of experience, in addition to King of the Nerds and American Dad. So wow. It's all very different things which have been happening at the same time, and, you know, I couldn't be happier.
Any chance of one more Revenge of the Nerds movie?
I can't imagine why. I mean, I don't know how you would be able to accomplish anything that anyone would want to see. You know, we're just a bunch of old people now. You know, I have this conversation so often because people seem to think that it's a great idea. I mean, obviously, if somebody came along with a great script and said, you know, we want to do this, do it right, you know, not the way we did it, subsequently, but do it right. And I mean, we did it right the first time, really. And, you know, arguably maybe the second time. And then, you know, that's fine. We did that. And, you know, I think that that's enough. I think one of the things that I would like to see is people to just say, that's enough. We don't need it. I mean, they tried to do a sequel to Revenge of the Nerds, a few years ago. And, you know, they got 3 weeks into filming and, pulled the plug on it. And, it will never be seen. And I think when that happened, it pretty much killed any idea of reviving the franchise. Someone tried to do it. They didn't do it well, but they tried to do it and it failed. And Hollywood is pretty unforgiving when it comes to that.
So no, like, passing the torch of.
But you see,
you
this
guys
is
to your character's kids.
We did that. No one remembers it because it wasn't a very good movie, but that was the third movie. Called Revenge of the Nerds, The Next Generation, because there was a next generation of nerds and we were mentoring them. That was the story. I'm not saying it was a good movie, but we did it once. We could do it again.
True.
You know, I mean, at the time we were just older. Now we'd be like grandparents doing it. It's just, if somebody can explain to me how it works and how it would be something that any studio would be willing to finance, I would love to do it, but I just can't see it. I don't see it happening.
I think the closest that somebody came recently was, I believe it was on TBS, they had like the show Glory Days, which I think you were a part of.
As a matter of fact, interesting bit of trivia, the frat house of Glory Days was the first season Nerdvana. It was the same house.
Wow. That's a little spooky. Yeah, because that was a show, when I watched it, it had that element of, you know, not the whole cast was nerds, but you had like kind of your sort of couple buddy outcast, and then you had like the guy that was always trying to get laid and things like, you had those tropes and stuff like that, but,
right.
It was set in the 80s, so it kind of had that feel of like it was like maybe the more the PG-13 version of Revenge of the Nerds in a way.
Right. Well, but again, we did a PG-13 version of Revenge of the Nerds. You know?
That was number three?
Well, number three and number four. They were both TV movies.
Wow.
They weren't feature films because nobody, even then, nobody would finance a Revenge of the Nerds feature film.
Right.
You know, but that Glory Days gig was fun because I was Matt Bush's dad.
Right.
In that. And it did have that feeling like the one episode that I did and then it was canceled. The one episode that I did was where it was Father's Day and all the fathers were there.
Right.
You know, it was not Revenge of the Nerds, you know, Redux. It was just, you know, it was what it was. It was its own thing with its own right. sense of humor. And I had a great time doing it. And you're right. It was a TBS show.
Yeah. It was one of those shows that kind of came and went. Like they just spit it out real quick and they had high hopes for it.
I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened with that. That's one of those things that's just weird.
Mm-hmm.
Because it did seem to have everything going for it.
Yeah, I really expected the second season out of it, and it just never resurfaced again.
Yeah.
So where can we find you on the internet if people want to follow you?
I have a Facebook page, a fan page, and I think that's... I think if you just search, I don't know how you find it. I think just search Curtis Armstrong on Facebook. I'm there. Okay. Other people found me. So I guess that's, I don't know how to do that. Now with Twitter, I'm on Twitter too. And it's called Curtis's Booger. And I should specify it's not the possessive. It's not the booger belonging to Curtis. It's Curtis is Booger.
That's
my Twitter handle or whatever the hell you call it. And I've been doing that since we started King of the Nerds. That was part of the deal. They said that Robert and I had to go on Twitter and Facebook. Neither of us had ever done it before.
Hmm.
Speaking of a learning curve, it's been interesting, but I now really love it. And, Twitter is, I'm there, and Facebook.
Excellent.
I'm actually in the same boat where for this show, I signed up for Twitter, and it is like, it's like you said, that learning curve when it's really intimidating at first.
Well, I really admire people who do it well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who do it well consistently. I do it well once, you know, every month. I'll come up with something that works really well. Otherwise, you know, it's hit and miss. But I do like hearing from people. And, you know, Nerds has been a great, you know, it's been a great sounding board for people. And people tend to respond very openly about their feelings, not just for the show, but their feelings as nerds. And I have a lot of investment in that. I mean, this is not just a show that I hope continues because I want to work. I have a considerable investment in the nerd world, in the nerd culture. It was nothing that I intended, but I do feel really passionately about it. And, I would love to see, those kinds of nerd values as, you know, even more, part of the regular culture. I mean, it's a lot more into it than it used to be. But I do have, a lot of interest in people and, it's been an interesting experience to see what they say about it. Mm-hmm. I'm also going in March, I'm going to be in Lexington, Kentucky at the Lexington Comic Con and be there, and I'll also be at the Philadelphia one, which is in June, I believe. So, you know, we do those. Robert and I will be at both of those, and we do those, you know, from time to time.
You need to try and get in, or MegaCon needs to try and bring you in here in Orlando. It's in March, this month.
Well, it's probably too late for this month, but
probably too late for this year, but definitely have you down because I would love to meet you in person.
Well, it would be nice to do.
And I know Marty, you've got what, Wizard World, Nashville?
Yeah, we got. I'm in Nashville. We've got Wizard World here. That Lexington Con. I forgot you were on that lineup because that lineup that they've got for media guests is amazing. So
it's pretty astonishing.
Yeah,
it's pretty astonishing. I mean, George Takei, who we just had last week on King of the Nerds.
That's right.
And I think Shatner's going to be there too.
Yeah.
So
Nichelle Nichols. So just from Star Trek alone, you.
Well, it's going to be something for me because, I mean, I at this point, I know George, and I worked with Shatner on, my dad says.
Okay. And,
but I want to meet all of them. Yeah. I mean, because I was a Trekkie. I was not a Star Wars person. I was a Star Trek person if we're getting into labels. And, I still love watching them. I still,
I grew up, you know, I'm 43. That puts me right in the era that I only had Star Trek until Star Wars came about. So which is better, Star Wars, Star Trek? They both served a vital part in my life at the time. So, I mean, it's science fiction. That's all I care about.
Right.
I'm more Star Wars. Because of the youth influence, you know, being so young, and that was more the influence. But because of my dad, I'm very appreciative of Star Trek as well, so.
Yeah, I think it was a, you know, I mean, you know, my daughter looks at it and just shakes her head. You know, she sees the cardboard sets and, you know, all that other stuff, and I just see, you know, something that, when I saw it, made my eyes bug out of my head.
Yeah.
Right.
So we thank you for being on the show. Sorry we took up a little bit more time than we said we were going to have you on for.
Well, it's all right. I really enjoyed talking to you guys. It was a lot of fun. And thank you for having me on.
Oh, yeah, maybe next time we can talk about the other 100 or so acting roles that you've been in. I think we barely scratched the surface on most of them.
One of the more larger roles that you've had was Ahmet from Ray.
Ahmet Erdogan, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was just an amazing role as well.
Yeah, that was a great experience.
We'll definitely have to bring you back on. We could do a part two easily.
Well, just let me know. I'm happy to do it.
Not a problem.
We'll do it when they announce King of the Nerds season 3.
That's it. That's exactly it. I like the way you think. I like the way you said when they pick up.
It's a no-brainer. It's TBS. They need some quality entertainment, and I think that's what the show is going to bring to them. Can't be throwing Seinfeld all the time.
From your mouth to God's ears.
Well, we will spread the word through what we like to jokingly call the Geek Revolution. We'll get the word out. Let's get King of the Nerds season 3 and beyond.
Hear, hear. Do it, man. I appreciate it.
It starts now.
Okay.
So, thank you again for coming on.
Okay, take care.
All right, thanks, Curtis.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Some people say I look like Dan Aykroyd.
Go!
So, Curtis Armstrong? I think looking at our guest list for the show, we've had some heavy hitters on the comic side of things, but definitely top three.
The bad pun that came instantly to my head because my head is full of bad puns was Curtis Armstrong brings it strong. But that's somebody to laugh at. Mostly me in my head, but that was a great talk that we got with him, and I think that still blows my mind. Like I came up with a list of probably half a dozen different shows or movies that he was involved with. We didn't even get to discuss because we got on a riff about, you know, really the main one of King of the Nerds and Revenge of the Nerds. So, but the Mansion
in my list. And of course, now here I am being almost a little bit of an idiot, and I'm gonna come out right now and apologize to Anna, his PR person. I apologize, Anna, for having him on, you know, that we had him on longer, but I mean, you heard the interview. It just flowed and we just kept going. And, she's probably going to hate us now. I cleared 45 minutes. You went an hour. Sorry.
You get the talking.
Forgive us. But you heard him say he loved us. Curtis Armstrong loves us. No, I mean, I just for my own notes, I mean, like getting back to me being an idiot, now I figured, okay, let's go back and start with, you know, his first film, Risky Business. And I mean, here's a guy who the 80s played with some heavy hitters. Anthony Edwards, Robert Carradine, John Goodman, Ted McGinney, Bronson Pinchot, Tom Cruise, Rebecca De Mornay, is it John Cusack? No. Who was the lead in, Better Off Dead?
Yeah. And, Cusack.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's Cusack.
Okay. Then who's on Two and a Half Men? That's a Cusack as well, right?
No, that's a Sheen. You talking about Charlie Sheen?
No.
You're talking about the other guy.
Talking Alan.
Alan Sheen?
No, it's not Alan. Is I thought he was a Cusack as well.
No, he's not a Cusack. He's name is escaping me right now. He's Matthew Broderick's doppelganger, so I see him, because he, especially yes. at a younger age, he looked, him and Matthew Broderick looked a lot alike.
John Cryer.
That's it, yep.
Okay. So yeah, John Cusack, I mean, one, the guy, you know, the fat, nerdy kid whose mom wanted to teach the exchange student the lesson of love, international language of love. You know, he went on to go on to, head of the class. You know, and of course the Better Off Dead has some classic movies or classic lines in it. You know, like the one I stated. Now, do you know the street value of this mountain? You know, I'm talking about the actual snow, not Coke. and when Cusack did, Hot Tub Time Machine, I was waiting for a cameo by Curtis, and I was waiting for a cameo by that kid going, I want my $2. but let's see, what else do I have down here for him? Damn Versus, which we touched on, Moonlighting, which I touched on, which we talked about. Again, Cybill Shepherd, Bruce Willis. I can't remember her name, Cybill's assistant.
Oh, wow.
See, I watched that show because of my parents, but I could have gone away and I didn't, because I actually enjoyed the show. I mean, it was one of these comedic, like Private Eye deals.
I love how Kurt, you know, just that whole discussion of Bruce Willis, like saying, oh, if I could be making movies, I'd be making movies. Now look at it. That's all he does is makes movies after movies. He
hasn't Alice Beasley.
All right.
Alice Beasley. Yep. And then, of course, you know, Emperor's New School, American Dad, Supernatural, which, you know, he touched on those. You know, he brought those up. But, you know, he's done some Disney projects. So it's, you know, he's working on Planes, Fire, and Rescue, which now, since he couldn't remember the character that he's been doing for 2 years, let us find it for you. But still, I mean, IMDb lists 137 different roles. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's what you call a working actor.
Yes. And then on top of that, the stuff he's been doing. And it was nice hearing the insight about King of the Nerds. And if Zach listens to the show, now I didn't want you to think I'm picking on you or being discouraged. It's when Zach goes off on this season, I mean, there's a few episodes. It's like a switch flips and you're like, holy hell, what's going on? This is a little uncomfortable and this came out of nowhere. But, you know, he is the youngest and I mean, this is almost like a coming to age, so to speak. For a nerd, 21 is almost like coming of age. How, you know, this is the adolescence time, not 13, not your teenager years. Everyone's awkward, but 21, you know, that's an awkward age. To me, I would think that's an awkward age for a nerd or a geek. And to see how he's handling it in such a fishbowl type scenario. And everyone's already socially awkward as it is, to have that flip, I don't know. I'm impressed with how he handled. I'm impressed when he didn't end up in some elimination, challenges. How he eases back and calms down some. So it's, you know, it's good to see that, you know. And it's also good to hear, too, that they don't try and cause the drama like some other shows by the way stuff's edited. They try and edit as it happens and base the edits around how it happens.
So, right.
And, so, yeah, it's, It was definitely fun having him on.
And when
King of the Nerds 3 is released or announced, we'll have him back.
There we go.
So, anything new with Rick's Comics since they are one of our associates?
Oh, we've got a nice, deal of the week that we've added to the website. So if you're looking for, depending on when you're listening to this, I won't say what this week's deal is, but every week we're going to have a new deal of the week. So go check out rickscomiccity.com, see what the deal of the week is. And for you podcast listeners, use the coupon code WeBeGeeks and get free shipping this month for any order that you purchase on the website. So go check it out there yourself and see what I do. Too many hours compiled, putting together the craziness that, that is a web store.
Well, also to check out, Nerd Rage Toys for your toy needs. It's who I use when I need to get, when I want to get some rare stuff or some older stuff or even some newer stuff, you know, toy wise. I mean, they carry some vintage, some new. It's a good mix. It's a good place to go. Also to check out, Nerd Block and their two options, either Nerd Block or Nerd Block Jr. And if you decide to shop through Amazon, you use the Amazon link on our site. You can do an initial search even from the site and it'll take you into our page on Amazon. So, check out our affiliates. Cause you, when you support them, you help support us. So, what else do we have? I think that's it, isn't it? For this week?
I think that's it. I think I'm tapped.
Yeah, I'm tapped. Kurt.
This wrestling, Kurt, if this, this were wrestling, it would be a 10 count outside of the ring.
I probably would have already been going, I tap, ring the bell, I tap. But yeah, it was awesome having Curtis on. It truly, truly was. I never thought show wise I would have someone like that. But then again, I never thought I would have any of the guests that we've had on, in the 62 episodes we've done. You know, to have this type of quality of guests that we bring you guys, over the episodes is, we do it for you guys, you know, for the listeners. So
if you, for us.
This one was a lot for us. This was, yeah. I mean, Ashley Eckstein was a lot us because that was a long summer trying to get her on, and the accomplishment of getting her on and being able to talk to her was great. But if there's other people you would love to hear us talk to, shoot us an email at show@weebiegeeks.net or leave us a voicemail at 321-219-8227 or in Southern speed, 321. Okay. 321-219-8227. Sorry. I used to live in New York, so people claim I give phone numbers out too quick. So, and, I don't know about you guys, but being a hockey fan, I know you are as well. Trade deadline. Oh, this madness. This was insane.
My NHL app was going crazy on me on my phone today. Just like one trade after the other, after the other, after the other. So
it started last week after we recorded with Ryan Miller and Steve Ott going to St. Louis.
Right.
Which I'm sure you're going, thank God Nashville's not in the West anymore.
The Predators here, we lost Leguan to the Red Wings. That's going to suck.
Yeah,
the Red Wings, like, in the same conference anymore. But,
and y'all lost Doobie to Dubinek. Where'd he end up?
I think he went to Dallas, maybe.
No.
No?
No. He's still east.
Okay.
Did he go Montreal?
I can't remember. I do know the one that blew my socks off was Martin St. Louis getting traded to the Rangers. That surprised. I thought he'd be a Tampa Bay player for life. So they're just cleaning house down there in Tampa, I guess.
The one that, you know, has been going on for years that finally came to fruition was Luongo back to to Florida.
Yeah, that's true.
Yaro Halleck, who was part of the deal from St. Louis to Buffalo, got traded from Buffalo to the Capitals.
So it's quite the heavy action on trade deadline day.
The one I love was Tim Thomas going to Dallas.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
And I was right.
Dallas got a goaltender.
Dubnyk went to Montreal.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the one that surprised me but didn't surprise me was Ilya Bryzgalov going from Edmonton to Minnesota.
Mm, right.
Which is the other team I follow. Like, okay. But between Halleck and Brodeur, who was on the talks, and Briz makes sense because he has a history with Chuck Fletcher, from the early, you know, from Briz's early days. Plus two, if he's gone at the end of the season, it's a cheaper contract. They don't have to worry. It's not, you know, because he's only like 800,000 or 800 plus.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's not multi millions like the other two are, so you don't have to worry about that.
Right.
But it makes you wonder what's going to happen to Brodeur in the off season. Does he retire? Or if he still thinks he's got fight, does he go free agent? Or ask to be traded, since he asked already? Time will tell.
That is true.
Time will tell.
Still a lot of hockey left to play to find out, too.
But, yeah, trade deadline.
Don't run away from your feelings!
Kind of hard not to when you see your favorite player go.
Ugh.
So, but on that note, shoot us an email, leave us a voicemail, let us know who you would love for us to try and get on. Believe me, we're trying, you know, we're putting stuff out there. So, but until next time, we're just gonna have to ask Leia to utter those famous words again. What do you think, Marty?
Oh, I thought you were talking to Leia.
No. I think Leia should utter those famous words. You agree?
Hit it, Leia.
Give the evacuation code signal.
I will bring you back a snowball.
All right, cut the chatter.
This ship will self-destruct in 1 second. This is your last chance to push the cancellation button.
It's over, Prime.
Why did I pick the blue pill?
I wouldn't trust this overgrown pile of microchips any further than I could throw it.
Hold it. I said hold it.
By the way, why are we wearing bras on our heads?
Clark, I don't like the look of this neighborhood.
Come on, Ellen. It's important for the kids to witness the flight of the rebellion. Kids, you noticing all this flight? Roll them up.
We be geeks, your voice of the geek revolution.
This has been a We Be Geeks production.
Welcome to the new sound of Sorcerer Radio. Version 3.0.
Sorcerer Radio presents the Sorcerer Radio app version 3.0.
We have the technology.
Check out our brand new Sorcerer Radio app for all iDevices as well as Android devices.
Better, stronger, faster.
Streaming Disney music 24/7. App highlights include a new broadcast window that shows you what you're listening to and what's coming up next.
Hot dog.
Multitasking so you can listen to SR as well as perform other tasks on your iPhone.
Gorge.
Listener access to all of our daily shows. The new interface, a new buffered stream, auto reconnect when signal is lost, visual EQ, pause, rewind, and scrub features.
My goodness.
And the new SR info area. Get your virtual Disney World fix today with the new Sorcerer Radio app version 3.0 from Sorcerer Radio.
Be careful with that. It's extremely dangerous.
SRSounds.com.
Pardon the interruption. I have some news which I believe you will find most interesting.
Would you like to hear the latest in Marvel television, film, and comic book news? Are you looking for some suggestions on what to pick up on New Comic Book Day? Well, join Mike and Ken every Saturday night at 8 p.m. on Mighty Marvel Geeks here on Sorcerer Radio, your source for all things Marvel.
There is a matter that requires your attention.
Mighty Marvel Geeks, assemble!
All wrapped up here, sir. Will there be anything else?
Introducing Rebel Force Radio,
your source for the Force.
Star Wars news and commentary
with Jason Swank and Jimmy Mack.
I've seen Star Wars 500 times.
Weekly live shows and podcasts.
Rebel Force Radio.
You are on the front lines of fandom by listening to this show.
Jimmy Mack and Jason Swank usher in a new era of Star Wars podcasting.
Rebel Force Radio.
RFR.
Like Rebel Force Radio on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
Stay tuned for special announcements about the Rebel Force Radio official webpage.
Leaving no Star Wars fan behind.
Rebel Force Radio.
Your new source for the Force.